Well, it's time. I better start doing my radio show now.
Well, I better turn that down.
Hey, man, how are you guys doing, dude?
That's good.
I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Appreciate you tuning into it. Cool, man. I got invited back on the Tom Woods Show, which means I'll be increasing my listenership by another few percentage points at least. Constantly I hear, oh yeah, man, I heard you on the Tom Woods Show.
Cool.
I have been doing this for a decade, but okay, Tom Woods Show, cool. In fact, that was what somebody said on Twitter yesterday. I wish I had heard the Scott Horton Show all along. Another thing to be thankful to Tom Woods for.
Well, got that right from this end too, man. Absolutely.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about Iraq. I'll go ahead and spoil it for you. Somebody wrote in basically with some sloppy talking points about how George W. Bush was right about Saddam and the weapons after all. Wrong. Nope. Ain't true. And here's why. That's the interview that's coming up. I think we've done this once before, didn't we, on the Tom Woods Show? Anyway, I don't mind doing it again. I like talking about Iraq War II and how they lied us into it and all the rest of it, too. Weapons of mass destruction. Give me a break. Anyway, today's show will include the heroic Gareth Porter. The heroic Gareth Porter. Well, he wrote an article about Parchin. Parchin, you know, the Iranian military base where some lying Israelis pretended a thing happened. Well, Gareth Porter's doing his greatest debunking. Nah, I don't know. He had a better debunking previously. We'll talk all about it. But anyway, so that'll be good. And then check it out. So there's a guy. And now that I think about it, I think he used to hang out in the chat room back when. I'm trying to remember anymore. But he's a longtime listener to this show. I recognize him from Facebook and whatever. Going back years and years. His name is Boyan Budimac. Budimac. Oh yeah, the C is a CH because he's Bosnian, right? Budimac. Something like that.
Whoa, my stomach's growling, sorry.
Hope that ain't picking up on the mic there. Boyan, he is a Bosnian journalist based in Turkey. And apparently he's been living there for 15 years or something like that. And he's written me, in fact, I don't even know his site and his stuff. I meant to ask him for all his links. But he's written me a couple of long emails saying, hey, you're interested in things that are true. Let me teach you some things about Turkey. And I don't know why I didn't just go ahead and have him on the show originally back then. But I can't remember what it was that reminded me of him the other day. It was something I was reading about Turkey, and I thought, man, I ought to get Boyan on the show to teach us some things about Turkey. So what we're going to try to do, what I'm going to try to do is get him to do, a good 10-minute teach-in on the history of who's what at a Turk and the whites and the blacks and all what it's called. Those aren't racial terminologies. They're socioeconomic terms in Turkey. All kinds of background. The Kurds, the PKK, the peace, the end of the peace, the war with the Islamic State. Oh, yeah, no, I want to get to all the current events in the second half. I want to get the background in the first half and then get to all the current events in the second half. And I'm very interested, and it's very important, man. I mean, this is the bridge between the Muslim world and the West, as they call it. They were trying to bring them into the European Union for a long time. Of course, they've been allies in America's military alliance, NATO, since the end of World War II. And yet they, as well as their American patron, up to their necks in all kinds of chaos right now. So we're going to learn as much as we can. And this is the guy to teach it, I think. The only thing I really know, almost all I know about Turkey, really, I mean, whatever, I've read about him for years in the news. But as far as any expertise I've ever had on Turkey, it's Phil Giraldi. Former CIA officer, friend of the show, sponsor of the show, Council for the National Interest sponsors the show. And when he was CIA, he was stationed in, I forget where. Anyway, he wasn't the country's station chief, but he was a big city station chief, I think, something like that. the other big city, not the capital, whatever I know. Not much. But anyway, so I learned a little bit about, Turkey and who's who and what. And everything that I've learned from Boyan seems to confirm what I learned from Giraldi, but just elaborate a lot more. So anyway, I'm just, explaining my own ignorance on the subject. I hope that you guys are all ears and eager to learn about what's going on in Turkey as much as me. Because I'm really excited to talk to this guy. I hope to make a regular thing out of it if all goes well. So there's that. And then, hey, check it out, man. I got Julian Borger for tomorrow. Julian Borger, he is the author of one of the most highly linked articles in my life. And that is, and actually come to think of it, most of those links would be inside just Raimondo articles would be where I kept linking to this guy over and over and over and over again a million times. The spies who pushed for war. And they're not the spies. He meant the Lockheed and Israeli frontmen who pushed for war. The CIA was like, I don't know, man. But the neocons, that's who he's talking about. Maybe it wasn't his title. Anyway, such an important story. The spies who push for war. And in there, it's one of the stories. He and Robert Dreyfus were both out ahead of everybody else on Ariel Sharon and his group inside the prime minister's office, creating their own little office of special plans in Israel to funnel bogus intelligence manufactured in English into what Hirsch called the stovepipe, the intelligence stovepipe, bypassing the CIA and straight into the vice president's office. The Spies Who Pushed for War by Julian Borger. Anyway, that's not why he's going to be on the show, although I might just ask him about it. But he also wrote this from this week that I just can't get over. From last week? I don't know. When is it from? From last week. From the 15th, West ignored Russian offer in 2012 to have Syria's Assad step aside. Sigh. So we're going to learn everything we can about that from Julian Borger tomorrow. I'm really looking forward to that. And I'm working on getting... Eli Clifton is going to be tomorrow too. Great. You know, for some reason, I woke up this morning... Oh, I know what it was. I woke up this morning pissed off about the Islamophobia industry. And I want to try to counter it a little. I mean, it doesn't really get countered by me covering it on this show necessarily, but at least it's, you know, can be a resource for people to use if they need it to try to help. But there's this young journalist named Eli Clifton, who formerly was with the Center for American Progress, who writes often for Loeb Blog. That's the great Jim Loeb's blog there. And I'm trying to remember what all he did. I think he was in on part one and part two. Years apart, they did these two in-depth studies. Fear, Inc. over there. And yes, I know the Center for American Progress is the Democrats. There's no question about that. But that's okay. Eli Clifton is still a good guy. In fact, it was funny. I think I interviewed somebody else from there about the second report. And she was like, Israel? What does Israel have to do with any of this? I was like, yeah, okay, great job. But anyway, Israel has everything to do with this. The Islamophobia industry is a fifth column. It's a coincidence. All of Israel's enemies are Muslims. So anything they can do to make Americans hate and fear Muslims ends up as, you know, a score on their side. It helps their position. In fact, if you look at Dan Sanchez's great article at antiwar.com today, remaking the great, or yesterday, he has a quote from Israelis praising the refugee crisis because it's going to move Europe to the right and make them more racist like Israel. Make them take Israel's side more. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime future freedom author Scott McPherson. Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here, the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at Darren'sCoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren'sCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. Darren'sCoffee.com. You know what, man? It's been forever since I played this. And it's good. Maybe some of y'all hadn't heard it before.
I don't like words that hide the truth. I don't like words that conceal reality. I don't like euphemisms or euphemistic language. And American English is loaded with euphemisms because Americans have a lot of trouble dealing with reality. Americans have trouble facing the truth. So they invent a kind of a soft language to protect themselves from it. And it gets worse with every generation. For some reason, it just keeps getting worse. I'll give you an example of that. There's a condition in combat. Most people know about it. It's when a fighting person's nervous system has been stressed to its absolute peak and maximum, can't take any more input. The nervous system has either snapped or is about to snap. In the First World War, that condition was called shell shock. Simple, honest, direct language. Two syllables. Shell shock. Almost sounds like the guns themselves. That was 70 years ago. Then a whole generation went by, and the Second World War came along, and the very same combat condition was called battle fatigue. Four syllables now. Takes a little longer to say. Doesn't seem to hurt as much. Fatigue is a nicer word than shock. Shell shock. Battle fatigue. Then we had the war in Korea, 1950. Madison Avenue was riding high by that time, and the very same combat condition was called operational exhaustion. Hey, we're up to eight syllables now. And the humanity has been squeezed completely out of the phrase. It's totally sterile now. Operational exhaustion. Sounds like something that might happen to your car. Then, of course, came the war in Vietnam, which has only been over for about 16 or 17 years. And thanks to the lies and deceit surrounding that war, I guess it's no surprise that the very same condition was called post-traumatic stress disorder. Still eight syllables, but we've added a hyphen. And the pain is completely buried under jargon. Post-traumatic stress disorder. I'll bet you, if we'd have still been calling it shell shock, some of those Vietnam veterans might have gotten the attention they needed at the time. I'll bet you that. I'll bet you that. Yeah. But it didn't happen. And one of the reasons is because we were using that soft language. That language that takes the life out of life. And it is a function of time. It does keep getting worse. I'll give you another example. Sometime during my life, toilet paper became bathroom tissue. I wasn't notified of this. No one asked me if I agreed with it. It just happened. Toilet paper became bathroom tissue. Sneakers became running shoes. False teeth became dental appliances. Medicine became medication. Information became directory assistance. The dump became the landfill. Car crashes became automobile accidents. Partly cloudy became partly sunny. Motels became motor lodges. House trailers became mobile homes. Used cars became previously owned transportation. Room service became guest room dining. And constipation became occasional irregularity. When I was a little kid, if I got sick, they wanted me to go to the hospital and see the doctor. Now they want me to go to a health maintenance organization or a wellness center to consult a healthcare delivery professional. Poor people used to live in slums. Now the economically disadvantaged occupy substandard housing in the inner cities. And they're broke. They're broke. They don't have a negative cash flow position. They're fucked. Because a lot of them were fired. You know, fired. Management wanted to curtail redundancies in the human resources area. So many people are no longer viable members of the workforce. Smug, greedy, well-fed white people have invented a language to conceal their sins. It's as simple as that. The CIA doesn't kill anybody anymore. They neutralize people. Or they depopulate the area. The government doesn't lie. It engages in disinformation. The Pentagon actually measures nuclear radiation in something they call sunshine units. Israeli murderers are called commandos. Arab commandos are called terrorists. Contra killers are called freedom fighters. Well, if crime fighters fight crime and firefighters fight fire, what do freedom fighters fight? They never mention that part of it to us, do they? Never mention that part of it. And... yeah. And some of this stuff is just silly. We all know that. Like on the airlines, they say they want a pre-board. Well, what the hell is pre-board? What does that mean? To get on before you get on? They say they're going to pre-board those passengers in need of special assistance. Cripples! Simple, honest, direct language. There's no shame attached to the word cripple that I can find in any dictionary. No shame attached to it. In fact, it's a word used in Bible translations. Jesus healed the cripples. Doesn't take seven words to describe that condition. But we don't have any cripples in this country anymore. We have the physically challenged. Is that a grotesque enough evasion for you? How about differently abled? I've heard them called that, differently abled. You can't even call these people handicapped anymore. They'll say, we're not handicapped, we're handicapable. These poor people have been bullshitted by the system into believing that if you change the name of the condition, somehow you'll change the condition. Well, hey, cousin, doesn't happen. Doesn't happen. We have no more deaf people in this country. Hearing impaired. No one's blind anymore, partially sighted or visually impaired. We have no more stupid people. Everybody has a learning disorder. Or he's minimally exceptional. How would you like to be told that about your child? He's minimally exceptional. Oh, thank God for that. Psychologists actually have started calling ugly people those with severe appearance deficits. It's getting so bad that any day now I expect to hear a rape victim referred to as an unwilling sperm recipient. You know? And we have no more old people in this country. No more old people. We shipped them all away and we brought in these senior citizens. Isn't that a typically American 20th century phrase? Bloodless, lifeless. No pulse in one of them. A senior citizen. But I've accepted that one. I've come to terms with it. I know it's here to stay. We'll never get rid of it. That's what they're going to be called, so I'll relax on that. But the one I do resist, the one I keep resisting, is when they look at an old guy and they'll say, look at him, Dan. He's 90 years young. Imagine the fear of aging that reveals. To not even be able to use the word old to describe someone, to have to use an antonym. And fear of aging is natural, it's universal, isn't it? We all have that. No one wants to get old, no one wants to die, but we do. So we bullshit ourselves. I started bullshitting myself when I got to my 40s. Soon as I was in my 40s, I'd look in the mirror and I'd say, well, I guess I'm getting older. Older sounds a little better than old, doesn't it? Sounds like it might even last a little longer.
Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org.
I love Bitcoin, but there's just something incredibly satisfying about having real, fine silver in your pocket. That's why commodity discs are so neat. They're 1 ounce rounds of fine silver with a QR code on the back. Just grab your smartphone's QR reader, scan the coin, and you'll instantly get the silver spot price in Federal Reserve notes and Bitcoin. And if you donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show, he'll send you one. Learn more at facebook.com/commoditydiscs. Commoditydiscs.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. It's libertarian foreign policy, mostly. Live here on the Liberty Radio Network from noon to 2 Eastern Time. LibertyRadioNetwork.com. Find the full archive. About 3,900 and something interviews going back to 2003. About half of them are with our next guest, the great Gareth Porter. Welcome back to the show, Gareth. How are you?
Hi, Scott. I'm fine. You do exaggerate a bit, but thank you anyway.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's at least 200. The last I counted, it was 150, but that was a couple of years ago, I think. A few years ago, maybe. So we're definitely up over 200 interviews now. And it's only because everything that you write is so valuable, I want people to read it. And so I figure if I bring you on the show to talk about the things you write, then maybe that'll increase the odds of them reading it, and then we'll live in a better world, man. That's it.
Thanks as always, Scott. That's very kind of you.
All right, so I know that this is kind of a little bit of a victory lap for you, too, so I'm extra happy to have you on for this. Iran's Parchin nuclear myth begins to unravel. It's at Middle East Eye, and it'll be probably the spotlight on antiwar.com tomorrow. So go ahead and tell them ha-ha, Gareth.
Well, as usual, in my pieces, it's not just one development or one piece of evidence that is reported and discussed in my piece. It's several points that bear on this whole myth pertaining to the Parchin bomb, the explosive container or bomb cylinder or whatever you want to call it, that has been in the news for 3.5 years now. But clearly the lead here is the news that Amano, the director general of the IAEA, has gone to Parchin, personally, set foot inside the building and found, guess what? There's nothing there. There's no equipment, of any kind, according to Amano. And, I mean, there's no surprise there, of course.
Yeah, but I mean, that just proves how sneaky they are. What are you talking about?
Well, of course, the response, will inevitably be that, yes, of course, we know they got rid of it a long time ago, when no one was looking. And, so that raises the question, well, you know, have the U.S. and Israeli and other, intelligence agencies been following this site in terms of satellite imagery for a long time? Guess what? The answer is yes.
Of course.
Not only that, there's commercial satellite imagery or photography available, which the IAEA availed itself of, in fact, immediately upon the publication of their November 2011 report, which first talked about the bomb cylinder in Parchin, the purported bomb cylinder in Parchin. What they did is quite interesting. They acquired all of the satellite photography for that site from February 2005 until February 2012. Now, the reason is that it was beginning in February 2012 that the first reports began to filter out that Iran was making changes on the site. And so the IAEA was obviously interested in finding out, well, you know, have the Iranians been doing something that would suggest that they were trying to hide evidence about that site in the past? So they looked at all of the satellite photography, all the imagery for that 7-year period, and they found that there was at no point any evidence of activity suggesting that the site was even being used, is the way I interpreted it, at least. Basically, no unusual activity, they said, in any of the photography over the 7-year period. So that's a pretty strong piece of evidence suggesting that, not suggesting, indicating that Iran had not done anything during the period from February 2005 to February 2012 to indicate that it had anything to hide.
Yeah, but Gareth, I don't know, man. David Albright at the ISIS, the good ISIS, he says that he saw satellite pictures of a pink tarp and a garden hose. And so that sounds pretty incriminating to me.
Yeah, well, that, of course, is David Albright at his most fanciful when he was, you know, pointing to anything new on the site as an indication that Iran was up to no good. I mean, of course, Robert Kelly had analyzed that and said, you know, look, this is simply a pink material for new.
Yeah, it's Pink Panther insulation is all. Corny insulation.
It's insulation which was being used to put in a new roof on the building. And so the problem with David Albright is that he refuses to acknowledge the reality that nothing that Iran has done changes the capability of the IAEA to take environmental samples that would show one way or another whether there was any nuclear material used on the site. And of course, they have now taken those environmental samples. That's the second piece of major news, which has been reported, the fact that Amano found no equipment in the room or in the building. The shed really is what it is. Was covered only very badly by burying it in the many, many paragraphs of coverage of this Amano trip. But the fact that the Iranians have in fact taken the samples and of course now they are being beginning the process of analyzing them has started, that has been covered very well by the news media. And you know, of course, they're focusing on the fact that it's Iranians who took the samples, not IAEA personnel. But I can tell you that the IAEA watched every bit of the collection of samples by remote cameras, which were focused on the entire process, and that there's absolutely no question about the integrity of that whole process. So we will soon know whether there was any use of nuclear material on that site, and the results will I think be able to effectively close this issue. Although, you know, once the results come out and it shows that there's not evidence of uranium or nuclear material, we know what the retort is going to be. Well, you know, they could carry out nuclear testing without using nuclear material. They could carry out weapons-related testing without using nuclear material. I can guarantee you that David Albright will make that argument, as well as others in the pro-Israel cacophony, the machine that inevitably comes out with the line that supports the Israeli point of view. But, you know, that means that the whole exercise is totally meaningless because there was no possibility of ever finding anything whatsoever. And there's no evidence one way or another. So that means that the whole issue was a fraud from the beginning.
Yeah. Well, an absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, Gareth Porter.
As one famous wag put it.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. All right, now, so listen here. There's a bunch to go over here about all of this. But the first thing I wanted to ask you, well, I wanted to point out that the whole argument about, 24 days inspection and all this, that was worst case scenario if Iran dragged out inspection of this site, not any of the nuclear sites, which are under expanded 24-hour inspection. Of course, the War Party like to conflate that issue in their headlines and in the way they regurgitate it. But so there's that entire argument shot to hell. The Iranians said, yeah, come on out. They went right out there and did it. And then now the music's playing. So I'll ask you the question now. You can answer it on the other side. I'll ask it again, too. How do you know about the IAEA overseeing the taking of the samples? I'm interested in that.
Okay. But hold it right there. We'll be right back with the great Gareth Porter, author of Manufactured Crisis, right after this. Hey, all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Talking with Gareth Porter about his new piece at Middle East Eye, The Parchin Nuclear Myth Begins to Unravel. And again, this is the Iranian military base where, according to some documents, they had an explosives testing chamber that they were using to practice imploding a plutonium nuclear warhead, fission bomb. And it's a bunch of nonsense, always has been. And now the IAEA has been invited right out by the Iranians. The head of the IAEA says, yeah, there was nothing there. And so now we're talking about whether that means that they secretly got away with moving it all, which Gareth has already debunked, citing the IAEA obviously looking at American-provided satellite photos. And American, you cite in the article, Gareth, American government employees even telling George Shahn, him quoting them, saying that they haven't seen what's alleged in the accusations in terms of movement from the satellite photos, cleanup, sanitization, as they call it, of from the satellite photos. But then, so one very important point that came out, another article by George Shahn in Associated Press said that the Iranians are going to get to inspect themselves at Parchin. They're just going to bring their samples and give them to the IAEA, and that's going to be good enough for the IAEA. And then there was quite a bit of controversy about whether that was true or not. And then when Yuki Amano, the head of the IAEA, gave his statement, he was actually kind of opaque about it. He sort of said, look, trust me, we used all appropriate measures and procedures in order to procedure the policy and the thing. And then what? But he didn't say whether his guys were standing there or not. Were they holding the video camera, or who was holding the video camera, or how did it happen in order to settle the controversy? But you said that you can tell me, which I think means that you have one or two sources who have described to you exactly how this took place. Am I right about that?
The source that I'm talking about did not describe exactly how this particular operation took place, but the source describe to me a way, a methodology for doing precisely this, which he is quite sure is very similar to what was done in the case of Parchin. And that is that there are remote cameras that can follow through satellites what is going on in a distant location. And that this source actually worked on the approach, worked on the methodology for this kind of operation, in which headquarters based specialists could follow the taking of a sample through special digital hand carried cameras that would basically send satellite images directly to the headquarters. So anyway, I do have this from somebody who I've been working with on another story, who I know is very well versed in this whole set of issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, I talked with Tariq Ralph on the show, and he was the one who said, a former IAEA inspector who said that he doubted the authenticity of the document that George Shahn had used, although there was a flaw in his logic. He says George Shahn is too good of a reporter to have gotten the document that wrong, and so I'm not sure if
I disagreed. I disagreed with that analysis for the following reason. One of the things that was reported by George John, at least in one of the stories, was that they had to hand copy this document. Mm-hmm. And in hand copying a document, a fairly, you know, fairly long document, I mean, more than one page, obviously mistakes can easily be made. And I'm ready to believe that whoever copied that document down could make the kind of mistakes that were found, such as saying Islamic State of Iran, rather than Islamic Republic of Iran. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's, to me, that's not really evidence that it was a fake. I think the problem was that it was a first draft of a proposal that later on was completed with more details.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that was what he said too, was that, you know, I mean, basically he described what you just described, that what they're going to do here is the same thing that they always do. It's a pretty standard protocol for this. And, you know, they'll take the swipe, but they'll be monitoring it. The IAEA will be monitoring it in such a way where they have plenty of confidence that nobody did a sleight of hand on them or anything.
Right.
Yosef Butt came on the show and explained about how they screwed up Syria because this inspector got a rogue sample, and it was his rogue sample that had uranium on it. But then, of course, it turned out that it was much more likely the uranium came from his clothes. Being a weapons inspector, he brought it with him. And so when he didn't follow the protocol, it ended up incriminating the Syrians for a nuclear program that they didn't even have at the time. And or incriminating them for building a secret nuclear facility, which they were actually not building at the time. So that was why they do the protocol the way they do it now and this and that. So, in other words, it just sounds like you're basically confirming what he told us on the show, which was that they're going to do it the same way they always do it. The guy takes the swipe, he puts it in the IAEA baggie, and off they go.
Right. And this approach of a remote camera that sends images directly to the headquarters that they can watch in real time has been used elsewhere, I understand. So there's no doubt that this is valid. Now, before we forget...
Sure. I mean, and that is a minor point, but it's been made into a major point by a bunch of liars, so it's worth refuting.
Yeah. Since we've just alluded to George John, I want to go back to that piece of important evidence that I discuss in my piece, which is hardly, I mean, it's just not known at all. I talk about it in my book, allude to it in my book, but it deserves to be more widely known. It needs to be more widely known. And that is that John was approached by an unidentified official, a state of an unidentified state, in November of 2011, immediately, like 2 weeks after the IAEA report came out, and was told by this official that intelligence from his country showed that Iran was in fact trying to remove actual evidence, not just evidence, but the important equipment from that building. In other words, they were trying to convey the idea that Iran was getting rid of the bomb, the alleged or the purported bomb cylinder, immediately after the report came out. But the problem was that this unnamed state official was contradicted by two other officials of IAEA countries who were following the same imagery, the satellite imagery, and they said, no, that wasn't happening. That's just not true. In fact, one of the countries was clearly the United States, because Admiral Kirby, who was then DOD spokesman, was asked by John about it, and Kirby said, no, I haven't seen anything that even remotely resembles what's being described to you.
Mm-hmm. So, and we know that's the Israelis, because when they say IAEA member state, that means Israel, because the funny loophole there is, of course, that they're not members of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and they don't have a safeguards agreement with the IAEA, but they're still an IAEA member state in terms of its original purpose, which was Atoms for Peace and that kind of thing. So they participate in it, but it gives them a nice little diplomatic cover for funneling these kind of lies into the intelligence stream.
We know it was Israel. I mean, it was the Israelis trying to set the stage for what they thought would be an IAEA mission to Parchin, which would find nothing. And so they had to set up the storyline in advance that the Iranians had already done this. This is the smoking gun evidence that, in fact, it was the Israelis who, you know, passed on the false story about the Parchin, the alleged Parchin bomb cylinder in the first place, mm-hmm. and realized that they had to figure out a way to get the story out to offset what they knew ultimately would be the discovery that there's nothing there.
Mm-hmm. And as you say, debunked even by the DOD at the time. Now talk about 2005. The Iranians, when this first came out, John Bolton put this stuff out for the first time in 2005. Is that right? Or it was earlier than that it came out?
It was 2004 when Bolton came out publicly saying, oh, we have all this satellite photography that indicates that Iran is working on nuclear weapons. And of course, it didn't indicate that at all. It was photos of essentially conventional explosives facilities or sites in the Parchin military facility that were used for explosives research, high explosives research, which doesn't mean squat as far as nuclear weapons is concerned. But that was what Bolton was pushing, and he bullied the IAEA into demanding to visit Parchin so that they could check it out. And the Iranians finally said yes, let them come in February. And they were allowed to go to five sites on any one of the four quadrants that they would choose and take environmental samples. And so they took the samples, found nothing. Then Alberti said, well, to be really credible, we're going to have to go back again. And so several months later, in November 2005, they let him come back and do it again. And again, they had the choice of five sites, took the environmental samples, found nothing. David Sanger, to this day, will not admit that this is what happened. He makes it sound like they were not allowed really to do much of anything at Parchin. But that's the truth. And that is, again, just very powerful evidence that there was absolutely nothing there, because the Iranians would never have allowed them to take their choice of five sites twice if they had any idea that there was something to hide there that the IAEA could possibly find.
Well, and of course, Gordon Prather says that's not how you, and not only him, but I think Jeffrey Lewis, the arms control wonk, and others have said that's not how you test an implosion bomb for a nuclear fission warhead anyway. You do it outside, like in the fake accusations about Maravan, not inside in a chamber like in the fake accusations about Parchin. So the whole thing is nonsensical.
There's so much more about this idea of the bomb cylinder at Parchin that never made any sense. And it's very easily connected with the whole, set of Israeli intelligence claims about nuclear weapons work. We don't have time to go into now, right. But I do talk about that in my book. And, if people are really interested, they can find a lot more that makes it very clear that this was part of a much broader effort mm-hmm. by the Israelis to try to suggest that Iran had done nuclear weapons work that was much more advanced than anyone ever guessed, and that might have even gone on as late as 2007.
Right. Well, and people can just search Gareth Porter and Parchin and find where you wrote the story about how the former Soviet nuclear weapons scientist turned out to be a Ukrainian, which isn't as scary as Russian, so they had to go all the way back in time to former Soviet.
The bomb cylinder story is all tied up with this Ukrainian who they tried to make into the nuclear test guru, including David Albright, who was part of the story, and which absolutely no evidence supports at all.
And also, I want to say one more thing here to add for people who really want to do some research about this, that this guy, Robert Kelly, the former IAEA chief inspector, he seems like a pretty sober-minded guy. And yet, when he writes about this thing, he can't help but basically clown on these idiots who've put this out, where he's talking about how in the artist's rendering, like Colin Powell put this together, and it's a biological weapons trailer or something. He says, so here's the computerized cartoon drawing of what this test chamber might look like if it existed. And here, obviously, is the picture of the nanodiamond test chamber that they copied it from. And you notice how in the real test chamber, not that it ever existed inside Iran at all, but this is some other test chamber somewhere else, I guess in Ukraine or something, that you notice how it's sitting on these big kind of railroad ties, these huge, like, what, 6-inch by 6-inch logs, you know, basically these big, railroad tie type logs. And he said that obviously the artist who was copying this didn't know what he was looking at and thought that they were some kind of fins that went on the outside of the chamber. So he went ahead and added more fins on top, just for symmetry or whatever to make it look right, and ended up basically drawing railroad ties or what would be railroad ties along the top of this chamber for reason whatsoever.
Actually, Scott, I've discussed this with Bob Kelly and he points out that what they were depicting in this artist's rendering was a very heavy, concrete shell around the purported chamber that would help to prevent any bursting of the chamber with a high explosive. It was all very fanciful, and that part of it had nothing, you know, that's got nothing in common at all with the nano diamond chamber that we actually have a drawing of from the book that the Ukrainian scientists did. Basically, I mean, the whole thing is just the Israelis trying to come up with another way of bolstering their phony story. And John fell for it, as he's fallen for every single thing that they've ever given him.
Yep. All right. And with that, I just realized how over time we are. Thanks so much for coming back on the show, Gareth. You're the best, man.
My pleasure. Thanks, Scott.
All right, y'all, that's the great Gareth Porter. The book is Manufactured Crisis, and here he is. The Parchin nuclear myth begins to unravel at Middle East Eye. And we'll be right back. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. Yeah, I kept going with Gareth Porter into the break there. A couple of more points to debunk. You'll be able to find the whole thing in the archives. Next up is Boyan Budimach. I'm sorry, because I'm sure I butchered that. Longtime listener and friend of the show and email correspondent here, and... I'm sorry, I meant to ask you, Boyan, to send me links to wherever you're writing these days. But anyway, he is a Bosnian reporter living in Turkey. I'm sorry?
It's mostly in Serbian, Bosnian language I'm writing no useful links.
Yeah, well, maybe you. Google Translate is give it a shot, but...
That's bad.
Yeah. All right, so you're a Bosnian reporter... living in Turkey, correct?
Yes, but originally I'm from Serbia.
Serbia.
I'm from Yugoslavia. What is left is that part of Yugoslavia is now Serbia. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit strange that I'm writing for Bosnian magazine, but they are buying what I'm writing.
All right, right on. All right. Well, so now listen, I got a few emails from you where I really learned a lot, and I was confessing to my audience earlier in the show that I really don't know that much about Turkey other than just what I've picked up in passing, basically, and reading about the wars over the last years. You know, I know a little bit about Turkey's relationship with Israel and, you know, a bit about America's relationship. As far as, you know, the situation with the Kurds, I read some way back in the 90s, and I've talked with Phil Giraldi, who was a CIA officer who was stationed in Turkey for a while, who has talked a little bit about what you've mentioned in terms of the fight between those who believe in secularism and those who believe in democracy, because in this case, it's the conservatives who have the numbers when it comes to the democracy, not the secularists, and how there's a lot of tension there. And so, but I really know nothing. So I really just want to give you this platform to give us, I'm hoping kind of for this first segment, a real good background of what you think we need to know about Turkey, so that then in the second segment, we can talk about the war and Turkey's role in it right now.
Okay. Well, the main obstacle, actually, for understanding Turkey is myth built around Kemal Mustafa Atatürk. Namely, that myth is supported by one segment of society here from inside the country, and largely is supported from outside of the country for selfish geopolitical reasons. So, namely, the country was based on ultra-nationalism, which is rooted in Young Turks' revolution of 1908. And basically, when Liberation War ended, Republic, which was founded on that nationalism by which everybody inside the border of Turkey who is Muslim was proclaimed Turk. And minorities were just, still are actually, just religious minorities. Now, Young Turks went through to the process of assimilation of other ethnicities, and Kemalism, I mean Republic, continued to do that. Now, we don't know anything about other ethnicities because their numbers were low. So the Kurds were the only ethnicity which had the number to resist that assimilation. However, the problem is it is not an ethnic clash nor ethnic conflict between Turks and Kurds. It is conflict between two very, very similar ideologies based on nationalism, Kurdish nationalism, against Turkish state nationalism. Mm-hmm. Now, that all changed. I mean, 90s were about that. I mean, PKK, the workers, Kurdish Workers Party, is, I mean, they have a veneer of Stalinism, Maoism, or whatever. I mean, put the cover of lefty ideologies on themselves, but basically they are nationalists. And they resist. And they, at that time, had all reasons to resist the state, which tried to assimilate them, not to recognize their language, not to recognize their existence. Now, what happened in 2002 was the coming of this Justice and Development Party, AK Party, and all game changed completely. I mean, the first, as I wrote you, the first, very first act with that government did was to lift the emergency, state of the emergency in Southeast, which is actually Turkish Kurdistan, mm-hmm. which gave tremendous power of to the military. Later changes include the right on language, all the cultural rights. Actually, now, everything what PKK was framing as their goal, except separatism, which they gave up officially in 1995, are fulfilled. And their existence is obsolete. However, the problem is that PKK is not just a national liberation organization as it is very romanticized on the West, but it is also the classical terrorist corporation which controls the ways of drugs, arms, and humans in that part of the world, which is billions of dollars revenue. So they are fighting for their existence because peace process, which was started in 2012 by this government, came very close to some final point where either PKK will disarm and enter the political streams or whatever. They decided to wage a war, actually. I mean, as I wrote you in Turkey, whatever is happening in last, well, good 5 years, can be explained into as an opposition to two major changes, and that is constitutional change. Turkey is still having constitution from 1982, which is the product of the army junta. I mean, army junta after the last bloody coup d'etat. That is not the last coup d'etat, but it is last bloody coup d'etat, wrote constitution, which is still valid. I mean, it is amended a zillion times, but you can't correct what is wrongly built. I mean, this is not democratic constitution.
All right, now I'm sorry. Let me stop you here, Boyan, so we can take this break. I don't want the live audience to miss much of this, although we probably will go into the next break after this. But anyway, hang tight, everybody. We're talking with Boyan Budimac, a reporter in Turkey, all about the Kurds and et cetera, like that. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Boyan Budimac, or something pretty close to that, right? He's a friend of the show, longtime friend of the show, a Serbian journalist writing from Turkey, and he's given us the background on the renewal of the conflict between the Turkish state and the PKK, and a lot of good background there. And so I wanted to ask at this point, what percentage of the Kurdish population of Turkey do you think, I guess, first of all, are actually members of or associated with the PKK, and what percentage support the PKK? Or is it really just sort of, you know, one little movement among a massive population?
Well, it is hard to establish for real, but PKK had never broad support among Kurdish population. There are a few reasons for that, but the main reason for that is that PKK is, in the eyes of generally conservative Kurdish population, a godless, secular, communist organization. And as I said, the vast majority of Kurds are conservative and religious people. So, I mean, if it would be different, probably the borders of this country would be changed long time ago. Right. So it is not big support. It is hard to speak about percentage. Namely, now in the last general election, so-called pro-Kurdish party, that HDP, People's Democratic Party, is their name, got 13%. But that percentage is very misleading, because it is reflection of the hate for Erdogan on one side, because a lot of Turks and Salon communists voted for that party. And on the other hand, there was unreported terror campaign before the election. So AK Party, till this election, was majority, was the party of choice for majority of Kurds.
Mm-hmm. But now, okay, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yes.
No, go ahead.
Well, now that looks that it changed, but as I said, there was a pretty unreported even here in Turkey, not to speak abroad, pre-election violence by PKK, where they were threatening whole villages. If you don't vote for HDP, we will burn the village. So that percentage, 13% for pro-Kurdish party is a little bit misleading. That party was getting usually around 6% on national level. Now, if Kurds are claiming that they are somewhere between 15% and 20% of the population of Turkey, now that gives you an idea about how they are supported.
Mm-hmm. All right, Kurds. So now what's caused... Well, first of all, to go back just a minute, there's Öcalan, I guess, is the name of the PKK Öcalan leader, and they had made a deal with him, and as you were describing before, there had been relative peace for a long time, and at the break you were saying that part of what has led to the change and the renewal of violence here is the question of, you know, the future of the Constitution.
Yes, yes.
Although it sounded like they'd be a lot better off under Erdogan than they were under his predecessors. But I guess obviously there are, you know, wrinkles in that. But then also you got to address the rise of the Islamic State and the fight between the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda forces against the Kurds in Syria and the role of that part of the war in the renewal of the violence inside Turkey, because, of course, the Turkish government is picking sides inside Syria and has been the last 4 years, too, right?
Well, yes, but that is also perception management. For example, that you remember that Kobane thing last autumn.
Sure.
That thing. Well, it is not understood in the West and not reported. I mean, who saved Kobane? Kobane was saved by Peshmerga, the forces of Kurdish regional government, namely northern Iraq. namely Barzani and Erdogan, made a deal to send Peshmergas through the Turkish territory to save Kobani. That is completely underreported in the West. And simply was made impression that somehow Turkey would like to, Kobani to fall. No, it's not true. I mean, they first of all, they opened the border, so all 200,000 people from Kobani entered in Turkey as refugees. I mean, 200,000. Europe is haggling about 120,000 refugees from Syria. Turkey opened in 2 days, 200,000 refugees came. And, as I said, they gave the corridor to Peshmerga for Kobani. Interestingly enough, the whole opposition in Turkish parliament voted against it, even that pro-Kurdish party, which makes complete paradox of the whole situation. But when you know Turkey and when you know the domestic politics, then it is clear. Yes, it is overflowing. The conflict is overflowing because, after all, that PYD, the party which is governing the those cantons now formed cantons on the northern of Syria, it was formed in 2003 by PKK. I mean, that is sister organization, and Turkey is regarding them as terrorists, as PKK. I mean, they don't differentiate between them too much. Understand me?
Sure. Yeah. But I guess I still don't understand. You know, or maybe it's just because the break interrupted us, and you never got a chance to explain about the changes to the Constitution. You're saying that you think is really what has provoked the PKK back to violence?
No.
You know what? I'm sorry. The music's playing. Can you do us a favor and stay one more segment here, Boyan?
Of course.
Okay.
Of course,
great.
No problem.
Okay. Great. We're talking with Boyan Budimac. And he is a Serbian journalist living in and reporting out of Turkey. And we're talking all about the PKK and the war with the IS and Erdogan's government, this, that, and the other thing. So hang tight. We'll be right back, y'all.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Okay, guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Boyan Budimac, Serbian journalist reporting out of Turkey, longtime friend of the show. And about time I interviewed him. Jeez, and I'm learning a whole lot. I hope that you're having a good time listening, too. Where we left off, how is it that the peace fell apart and PKK went back to war against the government of Turkey?
Well, they got scared from peace. Of peace. That is not strange, because after all, the leaders of PKK are 30 something years on the mountain. So what they are going to do in peace? Be retired guerrillas? I mean, and PKK is a pretty much cult organization. Not that much as MEK, Mujahideen al-Khalq, but close. Not very, very far away. I mean, I recommend the book of Alize Marcus, Blood and Belief, about PKK. It is not objective book, by no means. She loves guerrillas, but between the lines, you can read about what that organization actually stands for, and that it is a cult. So basically, they got afraid of peace, and losing the power, losing the money. As I said, they are controlling that part of the world, which is the smuggler route for dope, for drugs, humans, and arms. So they decided, despite the good achievement, I mean, good result of their political wing in last elections, to wage a war. Namely, they announced a break in the ceasefire on 11th of July. That is more than a week before that terrorist attack, which is later claimed as a cause of renewing the violence.
Mm-hmm.
So where it is going now, nobody actually knows, because this peace process, which started in 2012, by the autumn of 2012, it is most underreported thing about Turkey of all the times. I was writing in 2013, I was having trouble finding any link in English language which is mentioning that peace process. While every controversial or not so controversial or mistranslated statement of Tayyip Recep Erdogan was widely reported in every Western newspaper, this was complete media silence.
Hey, this is a very important point. I mean, people take note. This is what happens when an American allied state for 70 years now or something in our military alliance here in NATO, when they have an actual democracy kick in and the democracy elects a guy with a somewhat different agenda than the United States, the Americans, you know, at any point will prefer military coup d'etat or dictatorship, and have it numerous times in the past, right, in order to replace the will of the people of Turkey, if such a thing exists.
Exactly. Exactly. And that is happening here now for years. I mean, very visible since 2009.
Do you think there's a threat? You think there's a threat against Erdogan that there could be another coup now?
Well, it is constant coup. It is constant coup, but not military. I think that times of military tutelage is over, but the civilian coup d'etat, I mean, Gezi Park, for example, Gezi Park protests were attempt of coup d'etat through the so-called democracy promotion organization. They tried to topple government.
A big protest movement that began over a park there in Ankara, right?
That's what I'm talking about. I mean, that was the coup d'etat attempt, actually. You know, I mean, nobody in Turkey will demonstrate about five trees which are not even cut, but they are just moved from one park to another. It was complete democracy promotion organization stuff.
Color-coded revolution style, right?
Yes. Exactly. And it was very funny because people didn't understand that. So, for example, Noam Chomsky, for whom I have great respect, sided with with the biggest capitalists in this country, thinking that the movement is, I don't know, leftist, socialist, whatever.
That's
actually, they were just camelists with iPhones, as I called them.
Uh-huh. So it's the conservative, it's the conservative religious versus the right wing secular nationalists, and then the young liberals are basically the dupes in the middle.
Yes, but that's conservative. One has to be very cautious with the label conservative regarding the Justice and Development Party. Yes, they are socially conservative, economically liberal, but when it comes to changes of the society, changes of the laws, they can be easily called progressive. And the other parties, which are trying to keep the status quo, are actually conservative, although they are calling themselves progressive. Understand me? I mean,
yeah, I got you.
If we are going to the basic meanings of the word progressive conservative, then in terms of reformism and, in my view, very positive reforms happened here in last 13 years.
Right, and now, but don't confuse the Americans, because when you say economic liberalization, you mean freeing up of markets, not socializing and destroying them, which would be the American usage of the term liberalize at this point would be, right, the clamp down.
Well, this is from economical perspective, it is very, very interesting mixture of the neoliberal economics, I mean free market, and socially responsible politics. So with all this economic growth, there is no tendency of bigger gap between poor and rich. On contrary, for example, there is no more people who are living under $1 or $2 a day, and the percentage of those living under $3 a day is in one digit now.
Yeah, you wrote about how. In your email to me, you wrote about how if you talk with the Kemalists about that, they'll just scream and cry. They don't want to admit all the progress that's been made economically. All right, well, now, here, listen, let me record you a little bit more into this break here. I wanted to ask you one more thing here, which is if you could explain why Erdogan is so hell-bent on killing Bashar al-Assad and supporting, apparently, al-Qaeda is his favorite, to replace him. What the hell is with that?
I think that actually it is a major mistake in a foreign policy, but made on the bandwagoning. As we know, the Syrian project is NATO GCC project, and it is all about pipelines. And Pepe Escobar has it completely right. Well, Erdogan, as being outspoken, actually rushed. You know, now he's not he's not taking much Assad anymore. But 2 years ago, yes, it was too outspoken and basically painted himself in the corner with that. I think that it comes also, they had a good personal relationship. In one moment of time. And he tried to influence Bashar al-Assad to changes and reforms which are demanded by the West. And it didn't work. Bashar actually didn't react to that. I mean, if you remember, in 2011, the Utolu now prime minister. He was a foreign minister. I mean, he was shuttling in the autumn. He was shuttling Damascus, Ankara, I don't know, some 60 times. He was trying to mend the things. However, it was not meant to be mended, because it is all about strategic pipelines and geopolitics. I mean,
in other words, you're talking about there are two proposed pipelines, one that goes from Iran into Shiite Iraq and then into Syria, controlled by Damascus, Shiite Baathist Damascus.
Yes.
And then the other one is from Saudi through Iraqi Sunnistan into Syrian Sunnistan and into Turkey. And how these two are not compatible. It's one or the other, and hundreds of thousands will die in the battle over it, apparently.
And real war actually started when Bashar al-Assad signed the deal with Iran. Then it started for real. I mean, that is autumn 2011. So that relationship has a lot to do, as I said, with the outspoken myth of Erdogan.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he often makes himself a bad favor for that, but I think now he withdrew that rhetoric. I mean, there is no much of such a hot rhetoric coming from here towards Syria. I mean, towards personally Bashar al-Assad.
Right.
Simply painted himself in the corner following NATO GCC agenda.
Right. All right, with that, I got to let you go. Thank you so much for coming on the show. We got to do this again.
Thank you.
All right,
thank
y'all.
Thank you. Okay.
That is Boyan Budimac, reporter out of Turkey. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment, MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to MPVEngineering.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, y'all. All right. So I just finally finished up that interview there. I hope that was interesting to you guys. Man, I learned some things. All right, so to wrap up the show today, here, let me tell you this. Where'd it go? I'm giving a speech. Make conversation, not war. A summit on foreign policy. It's the Texas Millennial Institute, and that's not John Hagee and the End Timesers. It's the millennial kids, the college kids, the young new generation of Ron Paulian libertarians. Boy, are they peaceful. And they're having Angela Keaton, Jacob Hornberger, Ted Carpenter, and myself out to give talks. And that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to say some things about some things, and then you guys are all going to applaud, and it's going to be great. And you're going to applaud, and then there will be applause, is what I'm trying to say with my words that I can't say. It's Saturday, the 10th of October, in Fort Worth. It's at Texas Christian University. Saturday, October the 10th, at Texas Christian University in Fort Worth. And I don't know if it costs anything or how much it costs or what, actually. It looks, by the registration thing, I hadn't gone through it. I don't know. Anyway, find out.
TexasMillennialInstitute.org. However much it is, I'm sure it's affordable, right? It's not a fundraiser for Jeb Bush. So if you can make it out to Fort Worth, then that'd be cool. I'll see you there. TexasMillennialInstitute.org. TexasMillennialInstitute.org to find out all about it. Okay, cool. All right, then I want to say, I read this story in The Hill this morning about how the Pope came to town. And everybody's so excited about the Pope because he's kind of a leftist and he kind of says some things based on morality sometimes. And he denounces capitalism, which ignorant people think is, you know, highly principled or something. But anyway, it's supposed to mean that he's willing to say whatever he really thinks. What a great Pope or whatever. So he came today and he stuck up for the anti-gay marriage licensing lady in Kentucky. Really? It's her religious freedom as a bureaucrat to deny others freedom of association. That's what you think, you stupid idiot Pope, huh? Government employees don't have rights. They're agents of the state. They have authority as determined by law. But that's it. Her religious freedom. Jesus, you've got to be so damn dumb. I mean, and I don't think government should be licensing marriage at all. I'm a libertarian. The whole thing is stupid. But to think it's a matter of her religious freedom? Punch yourself in the eye. Idiots. God almighty, I swear. Yeah, America, where, hey, at least the government is free to do whatever they want to you, huh? At least I know that. Anyway, and then the Pope's other comment was, global warming. Oh, yeah, sign a treaty. Take all our carbon away and make us all poor based on a bunch of crap. Invent a new global currency of pollution credits for Goldman Sachs to sell derivatives based on. Oh, it'll all be great. The Pope said that, you know, something's got to be done by the American Empire about the global of the warming there. Oh, they're globally warming. But you know what he didn't have a word to say about? The Empire. Mass killing. Far better than 1 million dead by now. Maybe 1.5 million, or I don't know how many. Millions of refugees. Since America's war on terror, you can read Raimondo's article today about, yeah, it's true about the mass child rape by the government of Afghanistan. Who do you think put it in there? Who do you think overthrew the guys who were executing child rapists? USA, that's who. How do you think the Taliban came to power in the first place? They came to power to get rid of the child rapist warlords. Mullah Omar, please help us, the people cried. So he came to town and he executed the child rapists. And became the dictator of Afghanistan. He was welcome because he brought what's called the rule of law to these barbarians. America brought the barbarians back. That's the true history of who's raping who in Afghanistan. But no, the Pope doesn't have nothing to say about that. Pope doesn't have anything to say about the annihilation of Iraqi civilization. It's gone. The Sunni and the Shia forever divided. The Mesopotamian Sunni and Shia. And the Kurds as well. And I mean, the Kurds are already pretty damn separate, but all the Arabs that lived up in Kirkuk have long since been expelled in the same way the Sunnis were kicked out of Baghdad by the Shia because of George Bush's war. Now it's southern, you know, there'll never be Iraq again. Anybody who tells you there will and that that's the policy is lying, or boy, are they stupid. Iraqi Sunnistan will never be ruled by Shiite Baghdad ever again. Not that they ever really were. Since the invasion and the split up there. Well, more than 1 million killed, 5 million refugees, and then all the consequences spread
on down to Libya, through Mali, into Nigeria, Somalia, Syria, where now you have another couple of hundred thousand killed, and millions of refugees, a massive refugee crisis across the world. And what's the Pope got to say about the American Empire? What's the Pope got to say about aggressive war? What's the Pope got to say about Bush and Obama, their indirect and direct support for Al-Qaeda suicide bomber lunatics? Whether they're fighting them or fighting for them, they're helping them. What's he got to say about that? Oh, you guys need to put in the Kyoto Treaty and invent some pollution credits. What a good-for-nothing representative of God on Earth this guy is supposed to be, huh? Yeah, tell us more about how we should brush twice every day, Pope. Is that what God would have us do? Take good care to help the little old lady cross the street, everybody. But never mind the greatest purveyor of violence on the face of the planet. You know, little Malala Yousafzai, the Pakistani victim of the Taliban monsters there, she told Obama to his face, "Stop drone bombing my country. You're killing innocent people and you're creating more terrorists." She said that to Obama's face. The Pope instead is what? Like the Rand Paul of Catholicism? Get the F off my television, you worthless Pope. Global warming. The hell out of here. Oh, and by the way, Obama's unending butchery of Yemen continues to go unreported in at least American media. It makes the British papers somewhat. And there's a little bit of a story here and there, but you know what? If it's not on cable news, it's not on cable news. Nobody even cares, and certainly nobody blames Obama, when of course the entire thing is his will alone. He is the emperor of the global empire. And you can say, oh, he's just a figurehead. Yeah, he is. He's also the figurehead with the pen in his hand. He's also the figurehead who can announce to a general that he would like his resignation, or a CIA director, or whoever he feels like. He's the president. If it was you, would you think, oh, I'm just a figurehead, powerless, in that chair, really? Well, instead, what does he do? He tells the Saudis he got carte blanche to murder as many Yemenis as you possibly can. Go right ahead. And all in the name of the Houthis? Like America couldn't just negotiate a settlement with the Houthis. But instead, we're going to let the Saudis butcher and starve these people to death. For what? Because Obama's mad he couldn't win a drone war against him. He could only lose it by bombing Al-Qaeda for the last few years. Now he's got to fly his their air force against their prime enemies, the Zaydis. Hope and change, man. Hey, at least he's not a Republican, right?